All right, if you've got a Bible, grab it and make your way to the book of Ecclesiastes. It's right in the middle of the Bible, pretty much. If you find Psalms and Proverbs, just go to the right a little bit. If you wind up in Isaiah or Jeremiah, go to the left a little bit. We're going to be kicking off a new series through that book over the next 12 weeks. I'll talk about that more in just a second. But today is September the 21st, and it was about 3 years ago, for those of you who probably about half of us, were part of the church at that time, we kicked off something called the Advance Campaign. And it was a capital campaign to fund building as well as to store up some monies from that to help with church planting as well as international missions. And so it was a three-year campaign, and it's come to an end pretty much. So next week is the last day, the last Sunday in the month of September. And so the challenge that we've kind of been putting out to everybody is wherever you're at, let's close the gap. We're a little bit behind pledges. That happens. We've done really, really well. I'm very proud of us as a church. Very proud of us. Thank you so much for your faithfulness. But let's do try to close that gap a little bit. If you weren't here and you want to jump in here at the end, that's great as well. If you are behind and you're going to close the gap and you can't do it by the end, let's try to get it by the end of the year. And we'll be good to go. Thank you guys so much. The Lord has done amazing things through that, and will continue to in the future. Today, I got two goals for today as we get into the book of Ecclesiastes. Two big goals. One is just to kind of introduce the book. Not a wildly popular book. A lot of people in here may not have even read it before. So I want to introduce it, and I also want to actually preach the first 11 verses. And so we've got those two things going on today. That's what we're going to be trying to accomplish today. And so with that in mind, and trying to kick it off a little bit, one of the things that I realized as I began preparing for this series and studying in preparation for these series is that we're actually beginning this book right in the timeline, right coinciding exactly almost with how Orthodox Jews read it. They normally read this book on the third day of the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths, all right? And that usually happens in late September to early October. And so we're kind of right in line with that kind of tradition that's going on with that. But here's what struck me about that. That they read it right then. Because if you have any familiarity, any background with the Bible at all, you realize or you know at least 40,000 feet looking down across the book of Ecclesiastes that on the surface at least, it is a ridiculously depressing book. And so it's just kind of striking to me. I mean, the whole book, it begins off vanity of vanity. All is vanity. Everything's meaningless. There is no purpose. There is no gain. There is no profit in anything. There's no point to the toil of our life that we live in. And so that's how it begins. It begins with an honest question that all of us in here face, some of us daily. What's the point of all this? But all of us, more often than we dare admit, we struggle with this, okay, this question. But here's what struck me about reading this book, Ecclesiastes, okay, and I was pointing to Lamentations, but Ecclesiastes at the Feast of Booths. They read it at a feast. They read it at a celebration. All right, they're celebrating. They're reading this at a party, and so it would be like going to a wedding, and then the wedding party said, "Hey, for our reception, we're all going to gather around and watch Schindler's List." Right? Those things don't go together. It's not a happy thing. It's not a celebratory thing. It doesn't add up. And who wants to go to a party and be all depressed and be all crying, snots hanging out everywhere? No one wants to go to a party and have that be the end result. But that's what they do. That's what the Jews do. They read it at a celebration. And in reality, I think that they're right in that. Because as you get through the book, you get to the other side of the book. It's not that everything's going to come out peaches and cream. Okay? It's not that they're going to, everything's going to add up and they're going to get all of their questions answered in a way that makes sense to them, makes perfect human sense, and there's a pretty bow on top to tie it all up and neat and nice and tidy. But there is an answer that comes to the guy's question at the beginning. He's wondering, I mean, is there a point to this? Is there a point? For all the work and all the toil and all that we do, does it even matter? And he gets an answer. But in between the question that starts at the beginning of the book, verse 3, and the answer he ultimately gets at the end of the book in verse 12, we basically kind of have his musings and his journal of his trajectory to get there. It's like he's given us his memoirs, okay? That we get a chance to look and journey with him. And he's trying to teach us, okay? It's not like this is just raw journal. He's got it worded on purpose. He's going to be throwing in a lot of wisdom that he's learned all along the way, peppering that in there. But he does get very raw and very authentic with us and say, this is where I was at. This is my mindset. And we're going to see him. We're going to get to be in his brain and in his mind as he journeys through this book. And ultimately, the whole book is a book of wisdom, right? There are 5 wisdom books in the Old Testament. This is one of them. Proverbs, in putting it this way, if Proverbs is kind of the path to practical wisdom, then you can think of Ecclesiastes as the reflective path to wisdom. This is how he's thinking. This is how he's processing. This is how he goes there. And one of the things that I love about the book, and that I love about the Bible just in general, is that sometimes sometimes the Bible is harsh. This book sometimes is very pessimistic, almost has a depressed tone about the book. And I love that, and here's why I love that. Just by the simple fact that it has that tone, it means that God can go there with us. That he understands, that he is not some safe, sentimental, naive, G-rated Ned Flanders, oh diddly doo, you know, type of deity, but that he is authentic, he's real, right? He's raw, he doesn't whitewash that life can be hard. He doesn't whitewash that there's a struggle of life. He doesn't call us to bury our hands in the sand and pretend that all is well when it's not. He doesn't VeggieTale the reality. And that means that he's willing to enter into our mess with us. I mean, the promise that Jesus gives us, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you. A lot of times we just hold that and we say, in the midst of persecution, I get that. But that promise is a promise over everything. And so that means that that he will never leave us nor forsake us in the midst of our doubts. He'll never leave us nor forsake us in the midst of our depression. He'll never leave us nor forsake us in the midst of our questioning. He'll never leave us nor forsake us in the midst of our, though perhaps short-sighted, complaining. He doesn't leave us or forsake us in that. And at least for me, that is a very, very warm blanket. Because that means that it is okay when I fall into a funk. Just down. Just melancholy. Maybe for a while. With no good reason. Just am. God's not absent in that. He's not absent from us in that. He doesn't leave us. He doesn't forsake us in that. And he's not naive to what it looks like. And he's not naive to what our mind is going through in the struggle and the questioning that we have. And while it is okay for me to not be okay before my Maker, he loves me too much and he loves you too much to let you stay that way. And the book of Ecclesiastes kind of lays this out for us. And so it's my prayer over the next 12 weeks as we study through this book that it would be an extremely helpful and practical time for us. That over the next 3 weeks, that we'll 3 months, that we'll ultimately see that everything does matter. It does. Everything matters. And while all of it matters, none of it, though, will satisfy us. It will not satisfy us. Only Christ can. Only Christ can. So it's my prayer that we will see this, that we will learn this, and we get a chance to jump into it today. And so if you're open to it, page 355 in the Pew Bible, I would really encourage you, if you don't have a Bible, to grab that and open it up. And if you don't have a Bible at all, take that one home with you. It's our gift. Let's get into it. Chapter 1, verse 1, Ecclesiastes. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. All right, who is this? This is Solomon, all right? Or an inspired writer is writing as if he is Solomon. Either way, the viewpoint is from Solomon, okay? The viewpoint is from Solomon. And the word preacher there is a Hebrew word, koheleth, or I probably butchered that. Hadn't had Hebrew in about 6 years, so probably butchered that. But it translates to Ecclesiastes. All right, and Ecclesiastes is a Greek word. Ekklesia means church, means gathering. And so this is a gathering, and the preacher is preaching. So that's why it's translated preacher. All right. So the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, our viewpoint for this is Solomon. And who was Solomon? King in Jerusalem, all right, son of David. He was king at the high point of Israel. Like all the wealth, all the prominence, all the power, all of those, that was Solomon. He was at the zenith of the kingdom of Israel. He asked for wisdom. God gave him wisdom. This was Solomon. And surrounded by more successes, more opulence, more pleasure than any person in here can even fathom. Having everything he could possibly desire and trying them all, he still hit rock bottom and realized, none of these things, I've got everything and none of them fill me. None of them satisfy me. And so he begins a spiritual odyssey trying to uncover the meaning of life. What if there is one? Is there a meaning to life? What's the point in all this? And this book, again, is kind of his memoirs of that journey and all that he learned. And so Solomon, he wrote 3 books. He probably wrote the Song of Solomon, which is about love and sex and romance. He probably wrote that when he was young. He probably wrote the book of Proverbs at the height of his wisdom when he was still walking with the Lord. And then Ecclesiastes, he probably wrote right at the end of his life after he had tried everything, found him lacking, repented after chasing after idols, both physical statues that he bowed and worshipped as well as idols of money, sex, alcohol, drugs, you feel it. He tried it all, repents, and comes back and says, none of it can satisfy. None of it can. And I recognize that. And so he writes his memoirs and helps teach us through that. But here at the beginning of the book, man, he's in a dark place. That stuff doesn't satisfy me. Life is bleak. I hate it. I wish I could just be dead. That's where he's at. And so he writes, verse 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, where there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, the ear, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those whom come after. All right, so that's a chipper word for us this morning. But we need to keep in mind that these verses are preparatory for the rest of the book. And so, like, when I was in elementary school, all right, Pine Log Elementary School, home of the Pine Log Indians, they taught me to write a paper, and they taught me to use the X123X method. Anybody remember the X123 method? Right, that's what they taught at Pine Log. But what it was is you laid out your outline, then 1, 2, 3. I mean, I was literal. They're like, thesis statement, then summary of first paragraph, second paragraph, third paragraph, then repeat it. And, man, I did it to the T, all right? But the X, that thesis, purpose, first paragraph, this is the X. These 11 verses are the X of my X123X method, okay? They're preparatory for the rest of the book. But embedded in them at the same time is the entire point of the book. Okay, but to mine that out a little bit, we've got to wade into some dark waters first. And so let's get in the place of Solomon. Let's get into his brain. Maybe it's our own brain. Okay, verse 2 again. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. The word vanity is used 38 times through this book. All right, 38 times, 12 chapters. You can do the math. That's where his mind's at. Vanity. All right, and the word means futility. It means meaninglessness. It means purposelessness. It means emptiness. All right, literally, the word translates as vapor. And so, like on a cold morning, right, when I elementary school again, when I was in elementary school, I rode the bus. And so we'd be outside waiting for the bus, me and my brother, and my grandparents on one side smoked. And so on a cold winter morning, we'd be out there, not really smoking, not saying that. But, you know, you can make it, and when you breathe out on a cold winter morning, you see your breath. You see a vapor, all right? And when you see a vapor like that, what happens? How long is it there? Seconds at best. It's there, and then it's gone. And Solomon's saying, that's life. It is so fast. It is so fleeting. It is here one moment. It is gone one moment. What's the point in it? That's Solomon. It's just gone so fast. Like, and this is just reality. If you ask an older person, like my great-grandmother, Big Mama, and that was her name, not making this up, okay? She was 3 months shy of being 105 when she died. Had her mind till the last 6 months. An amazing mind. An amazing woman. Born in 1891. Met Teddy Roosevelt when she was in college. Amazing, amazing woman. But you could ask her when she's 104 years old and she'd be like, life, over a century, life went by like that. And even for some of us way younger than that, we still can look back and be like, man, it was just yesterday that my child was born. It was just yesterday that I was born. I mean, it was like that. It just happens. And the older you get, the faster it goes. Life is a vapor. It is here and gone so fast. But not only is life a vapor in the sense of when you breathe out, you see that vapor and then it vanishes. Also, when you breathe out, man, you can't grab that. You can't get your arms around that. And he's saying it's the same way with life. It just seems pointless. I can't get my arms around it. I can't grab hold of it. It's just so ethereal. It's just gone before I even realize it. And so Solomon asks an honest question then. And again, I love this. He's honest. The Bible doesn't sugarcoat the complexities of life. And so he's struggling. And so he asks verse 3, just heartfelt, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And then he goes on this tirade about the futility of life under the sun. the futility of life under the sun, that no matter how hard he works or whatever, at the end of the day, there's just no gain for it. There's no profit for it. The word can be translated. It profits a man nothing. There's no point in it. It's vanity. It's vapor. It's futility. And so if you're taking notes, this is going to be the first one I want you to write down. It's Solomon's point. It's Solomon's viewpoint. And so it's number one, the futility of life under the sun. The futility of life under the sun. And he's going to break it down, this tirade, with some examples from nature, all right, from creation, and then some examples from human experience. And so look at verse 3 with me again. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Rhetorical question, the answer being nothing. And here he starts proving it. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full to the place where the streams flow. There they will flow again. And so what he's saying is that life is like a treadmill. It's just kind of almost this mind-numbing circular pattern that we all get caught up in. And at the end of the day, there's a generation that's born, and there's a generation that's going out, that's fading. And this generation, they come on the scene, they run with all their vigor, but just like a sweaty man on a treadmill, they get nowhere. They get nowhere. There's no gain for it. They're just a hamster on a wheel. He didn't go anywhere. And so generations come, generations go. Makes no difference, Solomon says. And so like the greatest generation, right? They're almost gone. The boomers, they're getting older. All right? Busters and Generation X and the millennials and all that. One rises and one's going away, and another one rises and another one goes away, and another one rises and another one. I mean, it's just on and on and on and on and on. Solomon says it's pointless. It's just going to be what it is. It is what it is. And you can get sweaty and you get your heart rate up a little bit by going hard, but ultimately, man, you're just a rat in a cage spinning your wheel. That's life. And it's the same thing with the sun in verse 5, and it's the same thing with the wind in verse 6, and it's the same thing with the streams in verse 7. We're stuck in a perpetual repetitive circle in the natural world and then into our lives. Just kind of caught up in all this such that our lives seem like they're in a rut, a perpetual rut. Just the same old, all the time. And our lives really are far more like Bill Murray's Groundhog Day than we'd care to admit. We wake up in the morning, we get dressed, brush our teeth, eat some food, get in our car, sit in traffic, go to work, go to our cube, go to our office, go to a new job site, have a new haul that we're pulling, whatever it is. All right, go to lunch, and we go to one of the five places we always go. Or if we brought our lunch, we brought one of the five things we always bring. Get in our car, and we go home. We sit in traffic. We get home, say hello, eat some food, sit on the couch, go to bed, do it again. And Solomon's fed up with it. He's like, this is my life. What is this? This is pointless. This is meaningless. There's no gain in this. It's, what is this? And we go there too. I go there. We're going to have to pay bills again. We're going to have to get groceries again. We're going to have to get the oil changed again. And again, he's saying, man, this makes no sense. This is vanity of vanities. All is vanity. And so verse 8 then, he says, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. He's saying, it's so wearisome, I cannot even explain it. I cannot even state it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing in which it said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. And so he's continuing to press his point that it's meaningless. He says all of these things are unsatisfying. They're just pointless. There's all this activity, but it's going nowhere. Just futile repetition. Nothing's new. And when Solomon says that, he's not trying to say that there have been zero inventions. I mean, if you got in the DeLorean with Marty McFly and Doc Brown and went back and talked to Solomon, Solomon's going to be blown away by, like, rainbow loom kits. That we have vitamins and gummy bears. Okay? The iPhone 6. Freaked out by that. Let alone, we put a guy on the moon. There's a space station, right? There's a Hubble telescope. We can see millions of miles out into space. He's going to be blown away by that. But that's not his point, that there's been no new inventions. His point is that there's nothing new in the human condition. It has not changed. I mean, every person who's ever lived has thought about food, clothing, and shelter, right? Every person who's ever lived has thought through, at least on some level, wrestled with what does it mean to live? What does it mean to work? What does it mean to provide a way of life for my family? What does it mean they've hoped for their kids. They've wept for their kids. They've wrestled with these things. Crimes, wounds, enemies, none of this is new. Dealing with the weather, the seasons, sicknesses, love, all of these things, on and on and on. Sadness and aging and forgiveness and commitment and laughter and dreams. None of that is new with us in this age. And so as one guy put it, putting a space station in the sky, all right, talking about these inventions, yes, that's new, but putting a space station in the sky has not kept our families intact. It's not delivered us from dictators or eradicated a selfish heart. New inventions make our bones heal quicker, but not our minds, not our hearts. And Solomon's saying it's all the same. It's the same old, nothing changes, nothing new. And so verse 11 again, there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. And so he's saying no one's going to remember you anyhow. He's saying, I've tried that. I've tried finding satisfaction in making a name for myself. I've tried finding satisfaction in being famous, and it's left wanting. It's vanity as well. And somebody's like, no, I'll be remembered, Joe. I'll be remembered. Experiment. How many of you can name for me your great, 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 great grandfather? How about your great-great-grandfather? How about your great-grandfather? Got a couple. But it took us to get to the great. None of us can name further back than that. And that's our own family. Solomon's like, I'm going to die. I'm going to be forgotten. What's the point of life? That's where he's at. It's a dark place. And again, being completely honest with you, I've been there more than once. What's the point? I'm just going to die. And somebody else is going to come along. It's just going to be this cycle that just keeps going. What's the point in all of that? Just lapsing into this funk. I mean, looking at it, I think Solomon's right on so many levels, that there's just a futility to life under the sun. Okay, I'm just being honest with you. And maybe that's where you're at this morning. Maybe that's your mind. Maybe that's you wrestle with that. Maybe we don't speak it. Dare not share that in a community group. They'd think I was weird. And that's where you share that. That's where you get prayed for. That's where you get cared for. But if you are there this morning, man, I want to remind you that God's with you in the midst of that. He's not left you. You're not forsaken. He doesn't leave us. He doesn't forsake us. He still calls, cast your burdens on me. I'm here. I care for you. I love you. Give them to me. He still calls. And so Solomon, man, he's in a dark place. And when we go there with him, we're in a dark place as well. When I go there with Solomon, I have those thoughts. Maybe I don't say them exactly like he does, but I'm in a dark place. And when we go there, we've fallen into the same trap that Solomon has fallen into here. And that's seeing the world purely through human eyes. That's what Solomon's doing. He's seeing and viewing the world solely through human eyes. Because notice, 11 verses contemplating life, and he's never mentioned God. Not once. He's viewing it solely through human eyes. All that he's spoken of is just what he can see, what he can perceive. It's life under the sun. And yes, life is vanity of vanities when it is simply life under the sun, when it is devoid of God. And verse 3, again, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And Solomon's right, man. If it's just under the sun, then it is nothing. But that phrase, under the sun, is a major qualifier we've got to see to his question. What does man gain by all the toil which he toils under the sun, just viewed purely from a human perspective? And when we view it purely from a human perspective, devoid of God, then yes and amen, absolutely, life is empty. We can get some hits of joy, some hits of happiness, right? But if this world is all there is, and we're just going to die, right? And this is it, and the atheist is right, and there's nothing else after this, pointless. And that is depressing. But the atheist isn't right. There is a God in the heavens who rules over the sun, who's beyond the sun, who's sovereign and who's good, all right, who loves me and who loves you. And apart from him, again, yes and amen, there is a futility to life that is lived simply under the sun. But if we'll get our eyes up and we'll get our perspectives off of a preoccupation with ourselves and our circumstances, if we'll look beyond the sun, it changes everything. And it shows us that there is a point, that there is purpose, that there is meaning, that this world is going somewhere. All right? And now nature's not spinning endlessly like some hamster on a wheel. It's spinning to declare the glory of God. It's not purposeless, it's purposeful. And so Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. That's what they do. The sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day after day after day, it keeps talking of his handiwork. It keeps talking of his faithfulness. That's how we view it. And so Lamentations 3:22, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. That's what we see. His mercies are new. They never come to an end. They're not repetitive, circular nonsense. They're purposeful. They're new every morning, showing us that great is his faithfulness. It changes the way we see nature, all the examples that Solomon tried to give of nature, and it also changes the way we see human experiences that he found lacking and wanting. Looking beyond the sun, not just living a life under the sun, devoid of God, but looking beyond the sun and knowing that there is a God who is over all of these things, it changes the way we see our experiences. Because under the sun, yeah, there's nothing new. But looking beyond the sun, we see that there is newness. Jesus has come and he's initiated a new covenant. He's given us a new word. He offers us a new birth. Gives us a makes us into new creations, giving us a new heart and a new life, new motives, new desires. He's ushered in a new age. And because of this, there's coming a new heavens and a new earth. And the day's coming when he's going to stand and proclaim, "Behold, I'm making all things new." And so although people gain nothing from all their toil apart from God, In a life that's lived just under the sun, through Jesus Christ, there's much to be gained from our toil. And so Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15, "In the Lord your labor is not in vain." And so if number one in your notes was the futility of life under the sun, number two is the fullness of life under God. The futility of life under the sun, but the fullness of life under God. I mean, looking for gain, looking for profit, that's his question, right? Looking for satisfaction in this world alone is like trying to buy medicine at a shoe store. Shoes are important. They really, really, really matter. But there's no medicine at a shoe store. You can't find it there. It's an important thing, but the medicine's simply not found there. And it's the same thing with this world and this life. Whether we move or stay, whether we spend or save, nothing and no one can make our lives pay off or yield the return for which we hope. For all the beauty and grandeur and dignity, the earth simply does not, and the things of the earth, they don't have that power. They don't have that capability. They can give you hits. But like a druggie, man, you got to get more. It never satisfies. It never lasts. But life under God, there is fullness there. There's joy to be had. And so the gain that we seek, the satisfaction we seek, simply does not exist under the sun. We've got to look beyond the sun, and there it is. Because, I mean, again, remember who Solomon is. He's way beyond us, man. He's educationally beyond us, financially beyond us, professionally, wisdom, he's just beyond us. He has every conceivable thing you could ever desire, good or bad. Right, he's got cash coming out his ears. He has hundreds of wives and concubines. He's got anything. And he's tried that. He said, "I've tried that, and it didn't satisfy." He's tried all of these things: drugs and sex and money and philanthropy and good works and art collections and all these things, and none of them satisfy him. It's all left him wanting and has left him broken and depressed, looking for it simply under the sun. It's not there. But under God, it's a different story. It's a different story. It doesn't mean peaches and cream, okay? But it does mean that there is one who's come from beyond the sun, who's entered into this world to break the treadmill that we run on. Who's come, John 10:10, to give us life and give it abundantly. And when Jesus says that in John 10, what he's basically saying is, I know that you're living, I know that you're breathing, but that's not life, that's existence. And I've come to give you what I've created you for. I've come to give you life, to give you fullness, to give you purpose, to give you meaning, so that you're engaged in this life, fulfilling and purposeful. And when we get that, the life is ultimately all about him, then all of a sudden, all the other things that we've tried to find purpose and meaning and satisfaction in, they just return to being things. Good things. Most of the time for us, probably good things. But they're just things. They don't dominate us anymore. They're not our master. We don't find our identity in them. They're not our idols. They're just things. And we don't have to keep running on this bankrupt treadmill of looking for fulfillment and purpose in leaky cisterns. and being dogs who just keep returning to their vomit. We've been set free through the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. He's rescued us from the futility and vanity of that. And he can fill our souls with the satisfaction and purpose and meaning that we're so desperate for. And that's why this book is hopeful, actually, and not depressing. That's why this book's read at a celebration. Because it's about joy. It's about how you can find satisfaction. That there is satisfaction to be had, but it's not found in the things of the earth. It's found, as we'll see ultimately, chapter 12, in fearing God and keeping his commandments. And standing in reverential awe of the one, of the maker of the heavens and earth, and the one who sent his son to bleed on our behalf, in our place, so that we could be reconciled back to the God of the universe through no act of our own, solely through the action of Christ for us. I mean, it's a gift that he's given to us, to anyone who will just lay hold and believe. A commentator writes, reflecting on fearing God and keeping his commandments, "The fear of God, which the teacher recommends at the end of the book, is not only the beginning of wisdom, as Proverbs teaches, but it's also the beginning of joy, of contentment, and of an energetic and purposeful life." And so, through opening his memoirs to us, Solomon wishes to deliver us from a rosy-colored, self-confident, godless life with its inevitable cynicism and bitterness, and from trusting in wisdom and pleasure and wealth and human justice or integrity. And instead, he wishes to drive us to see that God is there, and that God is good, and that God is generous, and that God is sovereign, and that that changes everything. It means that there's purpose. You are not here by accident. Like in the world and even in this moment, you're not here by accident. Life's not random. There's order. There's purpose. There's fulfillment to be had from a gracious and good God. But you can't find medicine in a shoe store. Got to go to the pharmacy. And so it's my prayer that through this journey over the next several weeks, and maybe even today for you, we'll come clean with ourselves. Where do I get my satisfaction? Where do I look for my satisfaction? Where do I look for my joy? What am I setting my hope and affections in? We'll come clean with ourselves, and that we'll learn to look beyond the sun and keep our satisfaction on automatic refill at the pharmacy of our Lord. God help us. Let's pray. Lord, I am not naive to the fact that there are many in here who are struggling spiritually, emotionally, struggling. Lord, I find myself sometimes right along with Solomon when I take my eyes off of you. And I again become an idolater, looking for things that only you can give and looking for them in people and in objects, in feelings. In activities. And so, Father, I beg your forgiveness. I pray, Lord, that even today as we stand and sing just in a moment, and sing just as I am in a moment, that we would recognize that you take us just as we are, initially, and as we come to you day by day by day, and your mercies are new day by day by day by day, but you don't want to leave us where we're at, but you want to take us and show us your goodness and show us your generosity and let us find our hope and our meaning and our purpose and our satisfaction and our life. You want to give us life. And so, Father, I pray today for those who are in a dark place. I pray by the power of your Spirit you would help open their eyes to the fact that there is one beyond the sun, one who gives meaning to everything. Because he's in control, because you're in control of every atom on the planet. Therefore, it has meaning. Help us, God, to this end. Show us your greatness. Remind us of your love. And let us all run to the cross for our satisfaction and our purpose. It's in the name of Christ I ask these things. Amen.